And then he wasn't feeling well, and so he went home right after the first service. He texted me right before the end. So if you did not get one, lift your hand up, and Brother Pat will come by. We did pretty well. Yeah, we did pretty well. We only have a couple right down here, and then a couple here in the middle. Very good. I think Brother McConkie's going to get them down the middle. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. We'll take your Bibles this morning and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. I don't have my vapor this morning. We were running late here in between the services. I have it, but I didn't have time to set it up. But I think we've gotten a lot of that idea already the last few weeks. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. We're going to pick up right where we left off last week, and we're going to go through the whole chapter. This chapter is fairly short as well. That doesn't mean my message is going to be any shorter, but there's less verses to read. So, but we're going to be a very easy to encapsulate this chapter as well. The last few weeks, we've been talking through the book on Ecclesiastes, and we've discovered that he says in this book, as opposed to Proverbs, which sees life very much of a cause and effect way, not in an untruthful way, because our decisions affect the outcome of our life. Our decisions affect what happens. And when you do what is right, and if you're righteous, you're good, and if you're wise, then things will be better for you. If you're not, if you're foolish, if you're the scorner, if you're the simple, then things will be worse. And God does not bless that. But the problem with seeing life only through the lens of the book of Proverbs, as opposed to the rest of the Bible, is that the book of Proverbs might make you think that if I do X, then always Y will happen. But the fact is, he tells us in Ecclesiastes that is not true. Because the things that we want to happen in our life don't always take place. And he says it this way in the book. He says, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. The word vanity, we learned the last few weeks, it means a vapor. It doesn't necessarily mean meaningless, because he calls some things that are good vanity, like wisdom and righteousness. And he spends whole chapters making a case for that at the end of the book. But it means it is a vapor. And vexation of spirit literally means to grasp for the wind. And most of the time we live our lives trying to make life what we want it to be. And we want to give to ourselves what we want life to turn out. But he says you do not get to decide what your life is. You do not get to decide what happens. You do not get to give to yourself happiness through maybe it's being distracted or doing things that really have no value or working hard or getting possessions. You do not get to give to yourself happiness. Last week, we talked about how we want everything to be how we want it to be when we want it to be. And he says the world, and we all know, things rise and fall, kingdoms go into power and they leave. Buildings get built and they get torn down. Plants get planted and they get pulled up. And we want everything to be a part of that process at the moment we want it to happen. But God is the one that makes everything beautiful in his time. And God gives us just enough understanding to realize that we cannot understand. He has set the world in your heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from beginning to the end. You do not get to decide when things are what we want them to be. Now, this morning, he's going to change the subject. He's still in the first few chapters, for the first half of the book, he's going to convince you that it is actually true that all is vanity. Because we'd like to think that we're actually more in control than we think that we are. Or when we really are, we like to think that we're more in control than that. But he's trying to convince you of that. And so he's going to use a new illustration this morning. He's going to talk about relationships. Now, relationships, he's going to frame this in four different better statements. He's going to give you four different situations that we can find ourselves in, and he's going to tell you what the best scenario would be in that situation. And then he's going to tell you, so this is exactly what the most desirable position would be to be in. And then he says, and sometimes it doesn't happen and you're not in control of it. And each one of them has to do with the relationship that we have. The Bible is a story of relationships. And there's a lot of relationships that we have to deal with, not just between me and my spouse, but between me and my friends, or between my family, my parents, the government. Those, we have relationships with what's happening in the world around us. And when I, a few months ago, probably about a year ago now, I did a series on relationships in youth group. And we talked about each of those relationships, you and the government, you and your siblings, you and your parents, you and the person that God wants you to be with later in your life, and for many of us in here, you and your spouse. And so we talked about each of those relationships. And one point that I made throughout the whole thing was this. In every single relationship you have, you never get to decide what the other person does. And we're always very frustrated when other people are who they should be. Like your spouse isn't going to be all that they should be, and your friends won't always be what they should be, and your siblings won't always be what they should be, and your parents won't always be what they should be, and the government certainly won't be what they should be. But that doesn't change the fact that in every situation you have your responsibility. And too often we blame the problems in our relationships on everybody else, and the other person blames it on us because we're not who we're supposed to be either. And that goes very closely to what he says here in chapter 4. At the end of the day, our responsibility is to do what is right, regardless of the situation that we find ourselves in. Because often, the situation we find ourselves in, God has allowed us to be in, even though we would feel like there's a better one that we could think of, doesn't necessarily mean that we're in control. Relationships themselves are vanity. They are not yours to grasp. Every one of us have had relationships that have come and then they have gone. People have come into our lives and then they have moved out or they have passed away. Every one of us has had a relationship where we've been hurt by the other person. We didn't want it to be that way, but it was. Every one of us has had relationships turn out the way that we didn't want them to be because they're not in our control. And we're going to see four relationships that are vanity. So let's go to number one and we'll open up the chapter. First of all, he talks about the vanity of justice. The vanity of justice. Remember, vanity doesn't mean empty or meaningless, nor does it mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that you don't get to decide when things are just and when they are not. So look at verse number one. So I returned and considered. That's a way that he often does in Ecclesiastes. So now I thought about this. So he's changing the subject from last chapter. I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done here under the sun. Behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors, there was power, but they had no comforter. And he emphasizes it again, the people who were oppressed, they had no comforter. He leaves his observations from what he was looking at earlier, and he observes something different. It has to do with justice. In the scenario he presents, there's not just people who are in power, and then there's people who are not, which our world would like to tell you that those who have power are automatically being oppressors and those that don't have power are being oppressed just by sheer default. But that's not what he's saying. There's not just people who have power and people who don't, although he's going to talk about that at the end of the chapter. But there's people who oppress other people and there's people who are being oppressed by them. There are always those who are pushed up and there are always those who are brought low. There are people who sit back and they eat their grapes, and they're fanned by their servants, and then there's the people who do all the work. There always is. You will never find a situation in a society where that is not true. Somebody will be oppressing somebody else. When I was talking to the kids about some things that they hear, I don't talk about politics very often, but the big thing now in our world is that socialism is better because it's more equal. And equality is great. Don't you like equality? I like equality. So if you like equality, socialism then. And the idea behind that is faulty on a lot of different levels. If you have more money than I do, then does that mean that you owe me some of yours? Or if you have a better position than I do, does that mean you owe me some more power by default? But the other problem with that is that it isn't even realistic. Let's just suppose we could actually have the utopian society where everybody is equal in money and in power and in knowledge and in everything. We are all equal. The problem is that actually will never happen because even in the most socialistic societies, there's always the guy at the top pulling the strings of all the people below. No matter what situation you can find yourself or conceive of, there will always be somebody who is the oppressor and there will always be the oppressed. And that's letter A. There are always oppressors and there's always oppressed. There's always oppressors and oppressed. America is a society that has allowed for more equality than any other civilization in human history, but there are still oppressors here. Letter B. There is often nobody to help the oppressed. This is what he's saying in verse number one. And so I saw the oppressors and I saw the tears of those that were oppressed. And it says, and they had no comforter. And he says that twice. Sometimes it doesn't just turn around for them overnight. I mean, there are some things that have been able to be torn down. And we talk about how slavery was destroyed in America. And it was really a lot of the Christians who were the ones sitting out as the advocates for people being actually treated equally in both here and in Britain. But I mean, there, think about how many slaves lived and died and slavery was there their entire life. We get to look back, we get to look back on history, and we get to see the process as a whole on one page or two pages or a book in our textbook. But there's people who lived that whole time and that didn't change. And he says sometimes that's true and things don't just turn around for you. Look what he said in letter C. It's good not to experience injustice. So then he's going to say, well, obviously that's not desirable, right? That's not the better situation. So look at what he says in verse two. Wherefore I praised the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they which hath not been. Why are those things true? Who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun? So he's got two people here. He's got the dead, he has a dead man, and he says that he is better off than the living man in context because he doesn't have to experience the injustice in our world anymore. And he says, and actually I could think of a better situation. It would be better than both they, the one who's not yet alive, because he's never had to experience. But this is what he's saying. It's better to not have to deal with injustice anymore. In fact, I'll do it better than that. It'd be better if you never had to experience injustice, ever. But the fact is, our world has unjust systems in it. Our world has oppressors in it. And the only way to not experience any injustice ever, he says, is to never have been born. Because that's the only way you're going to avoid it. Why? Because that's the world that you live in. And we can spend our life trying to make the world what we want it to be, except for at the moment, that is something that we might be handed. That may be a situation in which we will find ourselves. And we can look at history in every society, and there will be people who oppress other people and people who are oppressed by them. Look what he says in number four. We always will. It is good not to experience injustice, but letter D, we always will. The situation he gives is he's saying this: in order to avoid injustice, you have to not be alive. But the insinuation is this: you're reading the book, you're reading his book right now, which means you are both born and not dead, which means that you are having to deal with people who are not fair, which means that you have had to deal with people who did not make the right decision, which means you had to deal with injustice. Had to experience people who are on the top and people who are on the bottom. And so he says, is that always the desirable situation? No. But that is the situation that you live in, realistically, here, under the sun. And we often want to turn it around to be different, but that might not be what we're handed. Now, remember, that goes back to chapter 2. That doesn't mean that that dictates our fulfillment in life. Nor does that mean that that's where our happiness comes from. When I was writing this, I thought of Corrie ten Boom. Do you know who that is? How many of you know who that is? Corrie ten Boom lived during World War II, and she is the main character, I suppose you would say, of her book, The Hiding Place, which is named because during World War II, they were hiding the Jews in their town. And so she built a wall in her closet, and so that when you walk into her closet, it looks like she just had a closet. But behind the wall was a hiding place where she would put Jews and she would cram them in there. And well, there was suspicion going around town, and there was some Jews that were sick, and so they couldn't hold back their coughing and whatnot behind this hiding place. Long story short, they got caught, her and her sister. They ended up going to a processing system and then eventually shipped off to a concentration camp. Her sister died in the concentration camp, not by being gassed, if I remember correctly, but just by dying of the disease that she had to live with there. and the fleas that they had to live with, and the situation, and the cold, and the lack of supplies or clothes so that they could stay warm. And for some, it was the Lord, but because of a fluke in the system, ended up being, for some reason, she was able to be signed off, and she was allowed to walk out. And she ended up living the rest of her life, and she lived well into her 80s, if I remember correctly. And it was not too long after that that the people in her group were gassed right after she left. So if anyone experienced injustice, it was her, trying to do what is right. I mean, she was trying to do what was right. Her family was hard workers. They owned a clock shop. And the people in her community were being taken off. It wasn't fair. So she saved them. That's the right thing to do. And now she's suffering for it. That's not fair. And now her sister dies. That's not fair. But she had to learn that those things are not in her control. And she said this, which is very apropos to the whole book. She says, hold everything in your hands lightly. Otherwise, it hurts when God has to pry your fingers open. And that's what this book says. We want our world to be what we want it to be, and we're very frustrated when we can't find that in our hands because it is not yours to take. All right, so vanity of justice. Let's move on to the next one. The vanity in financial perception. This is an interesting one. I'll go by it quickly, but I just thought it's interesting how he phrases this. But once again, he gives you a perfect situation and then says, but you're never going to find yourself in here. So he's going to give you two sides of the coin. So letter A, let me give you the first one. You will be envied if we gain from working hard. If we gain, so you work hard, you're good with your money, and you end up doing better because of it, people will envy you. This is what he says. Look at verse number 4. He's changing the subject. Again, I considered all travail and every watch. Right work. So somebody worked and they did it correctly. They didn't, as opposed to many of the times in the Bible where it says they worked, but they had to be dishonest. They had to take advantage of people. They did it right. Right work. And for this, a man is envied of his neighbor. He said, this also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So you got the guy and he has a lot of things. He's got the nice house, he's got the nice car, and he got the new Apple Watch, and he got the brand new iPad and the brand new MacBook, and he got all the stuff. And then you're like, man, why don't I have that? Well, maybe he worked hard, maybe he's smart with his money, maybe he's frugal, maybe he coupons and he has extra money. I don't know. But he will be envied of his neighbor. He will be. Somebody will envy him because he worked hard and he got things. Look at the other side of this, letter B. But you will have nothing if we don't work. So I considered the travail, every right work, and for this a man is envied of his neighbor. Now look at verse 5. And the fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. So the two sides of the coin. Man worked hard, envied of his neighbor. Other guy, fool, didn't do anything. He folded his hands together. And then eateth his own flesh means that he had to like devour his own life. He didn't have anything, and he's eating himself from the inside out. His life's falling apart. Why? Because he didn't work hard. The Bible tells us all that throughout the book of Proverbs. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore, he will beg in harvest and have nothing. So you have two sides. You have the guy who works hard and he gains from it. And then people look at him crossways. Then you have the guy who doesn't work enough and he doesn't have enough. And so people look at him crossways, right? Is that not true? Is that not where we live? Why does he have so much? Why doesn't he have enough? And so what would be the best scenario? Look in verse number 6. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full of travail and vexation of spirit. Letter C. It is good to have the perfect amount. That's what he says. That's how he framed it. He worked hard, had too much, he's envied. Didn't work enough, didn't have enough. So what's best? To have exactly the right amount always, so that people don't look at you poorly. But the problem is, letter D, we never will. You're never going to have the perfect amount to please everybody. Verse 7, and then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. It would be great if you always just had enough to pay your bills and just enough that everybody thought that you were being financially, smart. But somebody's always going to look at you crossways. It's interesting how this finds its way in the middle. Because a lot of times we live our lives based upon the perception of the people around us too. We make decisions because of how we're going to be perceived. We do what we do, or we buy what we buy, or we don't buy what we buy because people are going to look at us one way or not, or another. And he says, you know what? You're not going to please everybody. You work hard, somebody's going to get mad. You don't work hard, someone else is going to get mad. It'd be better if you had a handful as opposed to having nothing in your hand or opposed to having both hands full. But no, it'd be better to have that. But this is vanity. It says, when you live your lives wanting to please people by the way your life appears, no matter what you do, maybe somebody would be happy and somebody else won't be. Maybe you would do just the right amount, you'd buy just the right amount of things, but the guy who is works with finances a lot would say, you know what, you should be saving more. The other person says, why do you have so much money? When we live our lives to please people, we're going to be disappointed because that is vanity. All right, let's go to the next one, number three. I'm doing really good this morning. You guys are listening well. Number three, the vanity of companionship. This is the one that probably hurts the most. Now, I'm going to skip verse 8 because I'm going to come back to that because of the structure of the way that I've been saying them in order. But once again, he's going to give you a perfect situation. He's going to give you a positive scenario. Letter A, it is good to have family and friends. It's good. Watch. Two are better than one, okay? So let me give you a couple reasons why he says this. Number one, to labor with us. It's good to have family and friends. It is, because they labor with you. So he starts by saying two are better than one. It is better to not be alone. It is. Of course it is. Do we want to be alone? We don't want to be alone. Then he gives you all the reasons why. Because they have a good reward for their labor. We know that. We operate on all the colloquialisms. Many hands make light work. We know about synergy. Synergy means that you can get more done together than you can the sum total of both of your work if you worked separately. You can do better. You have a good reward for your labor. And so two are better than one. To labor with us, number two, to pick us up. It's better to have family and friends to pick us up. Our fellows are coming by. If you can drop off the attendance slip in there, we'd appreciate that. Verse 10, for if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Now that goes physically. Like when you're out in the field and you fall in that rant, in that ditch, or you get your feet stuck in the mud. Pastor talked about that the other week. We're going to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And the reason why that saying exists is because you can't pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. That's not actually physically possible. And he said, why? Well, when you're out and you need somebody to help you up, it's good to have family and friends there around. Who's going to be somebody to help you up and not just point and laugh that your feet are stuck in the mud?
My tractor's stuck in the mud, then I call you to come down and help me.
Yeah, well, like actually? Do you need me to come pull your tractor? Oh, okay. Yeah, we've done that before. And the fact is, that's also true spiritually. When you have a family of friends and they're hurting and they fall, he needs people in your life to help you up, to pick you up. Let's go to the next one. Number three, to care for us. It's good to have family and friends to care for us. Again, verse 11, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? It's like you cannot in a cold evening, you and your spouse sit around a fireplace and actually huddle up and get, you can huddle up and have body heat, and you can snuggle and cuddle and be warm. It says you can't snuggle and cuddle by yourself. Doesn't work that way. So people have tried, but you can't really do that. You need someone else. Number four, to protect us. To protect us. Verse 12, if one prevail against him. So now you have somebody who's attacking you. There's somebody who is seeking your harm. Wouldn't you want somebody else there with you? Two shall withstand him. He says, and the threefold cord is not quickly broken. Even better than that, it'd be better to have another person, it'd be better to have two other people. And he gives an example of a rope. You have three that are together and they're wound together. You cannot quickly break it. So that sounds great, doesn't it? Great to have friends. It's better not to be alone. Two are better than one because they'll be there for you. They'll labor with you. They'll be there to cuddle with you. They'll be there to work with you. They'll be there to pick you up. But letter B, we don't always have them. We don't. You know, what's interesting is we tend to quote Ecclesiastes 4 and the last few verses I just quoted all by themselves. Because it is true. Is that the desirable situation? Of course it is. Two are better than one. But he actually starts that whole series in verse 8. Verse 8. There is one alone. That's how he started that section. Before he said two are better than one, he had a picture of a person that didn't have a second. And so that means he didn't have somebody to pick him up or to help him or to snuggle. So he was alone. There is one alone, and there is not a second. He hath neither child or brother, and there is no end of all his labor, neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Why? Well, who is he gaining things for? Neither saith he, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? This also is vanity, yea, it is a sore travail. This is what he's saying. Remember the theme of the whole book. God is the creator, and God is in charge, and you are not. Could you think of a better situation that you could find yourself in? Sure. Sure he could. So when somebody passes away in your life, would it be nicer if they were around? Sure it would be. Of course it would. Your friend had to move away, or maybe you grew apart, or your schedules changed, and so you're not together anymore. Is that what you would want? Of course not. It's nicer to have them around. Of course it is. But he says, but sometimes that's just not what you have. Watch. Sometimes that's not what you were given today. Because God gives you people in your life, and sometimes he may not. But nothing in this life is yours to take. We always joke around, Sam and I, when we were dating, we said this, we still think this. We were like, you know what, we want to die at the exact same time. How many of you said that? I want to die, just me? No, oh, sorry. I want to die at the exact same time. If we're going to die, I want to live till we're 97 and a half and get in a car accident and don't feel a thing. That would be desirable. And we laugh. Do you know why we laugh? Do you laugh at me because I would rather not live without Sam as my spouse? Are you surprised that I don't want to have her pass away and then to live alone? Of course you're not. That's not what you're surprised about. You laugh because it is an unrealistic situation to desire. It's not an undesirable situation to want. It's just an unrealistic one. Why? Because sometimes you're given relationships and sometimes you're not. And that's just true. Well, he must have been depressed. Ask yourselves, is he lying to you? Because sometimes there is one and there's not a second. And what he wants us to do in this book is not get mad at the situation that we feel like could be better, but what he wants us to do in this book is to recognize that we don't get to decide what God hands us today. We just get to decide what we do with the day that we are given. And the day that we're given today might not be the day we were given yesterday. And the relationships that we're given today might not be the relationships we were given yesterday. That does not mean that we could not want something different. It just means we have to trust that God's in charge and we are not. Because relationships are vanity as well. I would think that few things would cause us to agree with the writer of Ecclesiastes in this one. Because all of us have experienced a relationship that was given and then was taken away. And we didn't decide it, but yet that is what happened. And we had to trust that God knew what he was doing, didn't we? And that God was in charge and that we are not. Vanity of companionship. And I'll give you the last one and then we'll be done this morning. The vanity of power. The vanity of power. This is similar to the first point, but almost to the extent that he's just drawing those who get to make the decisions in the world and in life, and even ones that affect your life, and then those who don't. And we want certain people to be in charge and others not to be. We want the wise people to be in charge and the foolish people to be the one taking the orders. But it doesn't always turn out that way. Look at verse 13. This is the kind of the theme verse for this section. Better is a poor and a wise child. So he's poor. Sometimes when the Bible says poor, it means they've been taken advantage of, and rich means they've been taking advantage of people. And that's the context in which it is. Sometimes poor and rich is actually contrasting people who have influence and people who don't. And here that's more the feel of it, because you have the child. When is the child in charge? Rarely. But then it says it, that he's wise. So that means he's knowing what he's doing better than the other guy, the old and the foolish king. So you have the poor kid. So if you're in a kingdom, the poor person is not the one in charge, right? The poor one is at the bottom of the totem pole, and the king is the one at the top. And the one's a child, so you wouldn't expect him to be in charge, but he's the one that is wise. Then you have the old one, who you might expect to be in charge, but he's foolish. And watch, how does it describe foolishness? Who will no more be admonished. So the old guy who has the kingdom and he's in charge, he's dumb. And he's got all the counselors that surround him that might actually know what they're talking about, and he doesn't listen to any of them because he's old and he knows what he's doing. So that's the situation it gives you. You have a poor and a wise child, and you have an old and a foolish king who doesn't take any advice from anybody. Letter A. So what do we learn from that before we go into the next verse? Power is often given to the foolish. Now, is that better? Is that the better situation that we can imagine? No. Of course not. But I mean, let's just open our history books. How many foolish people had lots and lots of power? That was the one problem with monarchies. Sometimes I just wish we lived in a monarchy. We got a good king and he just made all the decisions and we went by all the red tape. But the problem with the monarchy is their kid might be as dumb as a rock. And here he is. He's got the scepter and he can do whatever he wants. And that has destroyed nations. Why? Because he's foolish and he won't be admonished. Sometimes foolish people have power, and sometimes foolish people get voted into power, and that's really weird. But they had enough money behind them, but they didn't know what they were doing, but there they are. Now we have to live with the decisions they make. And if you're striving and people, we're frustrated by the power, the popularity, and the influence that people have, we just have to rest in the fact that that happens. That happens sometimes, and that's not ours to control. I don't really like to watch the news ever, but sometimes I turn it on and I'm thinking, man, how are these people where they are? Why does anyone listen to them? I'm really surprised. Like, even if you don't agree with anything that I believe, at least you have to recognize that, man, that guy does not have it going on. But sometimes that happens. Sometimes power is given to the foolish. Letter B, injustice is often given to the wise, on the other hand. So you have the poor and the wise child, and the old and foolish king. Later on, look at verse number 14. I'm going to get to that in here in just a second. For out of prison he cometh. So now we see this, that the poor and the wise child was in prison for some reason. So not only was he not given the power and the influence that maybe he could have better taken advantage of, but also somehow, in some situation, in his hypothetical scenario, this guy has experienced injustice as well. The poor and the wise child is now thrown in prison for some reason. And then you have the dumb king who gets to do whatever he wants. When I read this, I thought of Joseph. You have the young man, and he's poor, but he's smart. And because he did what was right, he ended up where? In prison. You have a poor, wise child, and then you have an old and a foolish king, and there's the poor, wise child just trying to clean the house and take care of the books. And somebody falsely accuses him of something, and he ends up in jail. And sometimes that happens. But, let her see, sometimes the tables turn to the wise. The tables often turn to the wise. Sometimes. Look what he says in verse 14. Out of prison he cometh to reign, whereas also he that is born in his kingdom becometh poor. And so then he provides a situation that starts to give you some light. So you have a young child, and he's poor, and he starts out, and he knows what he's doing, and he really deserves the throne. Then you have a guy who doesn't deserve the throne, who has the throne. And he says he comes out of prison, and he reigns. And the one who was born in the kingdom, the one who should have gotten the throne next, he ends up becoming poor. And then we're all happy. It all switched how he wanted it to. And so who did I think of? I thought of Joseph. So Joseph comes out of prison, and he gets more influence than anybody else does in the world. And we're all very happy about how the end of Genesis ends, aren't we? Everything turned out right because God always makes things turn out the way we want them to. I mean, he says at the end of Genesis chapter 50, you thought evil against me, but God meant it to good to bring to pass as is this day to save much people alive. He made it all work out. And just like last week, and he's going to make it all work out on our speck of our timeline. Everything's going to work out. That's how he finishes this, letter D. But power and popularity are never permanent. Talking about power, sometimes it's given to the foolish people. Sometimes it turns around, it's given to the wise person. And then sometimes it goes back to the way it was before. Look at how he finishes this chapter. Ecclesiastes isn't really fair. He doesn't always end on the happy note. He ends on the realistic note. Verse 15. So now we have the guy who started out, he was thrown in prison, he didn't deserve it, and he was on the bottom of the totem pole, but he was wise. He's put as the king, and the people who didn't deserve the kingdom, though they started with it, they are the ones that are put on the bottom of the totem pole. Verse 15, I considered all the living which walk under the sun, watch this, with the second child that shall stand up in his stead. So you got the king who's now in charge, and now he has a son. And he stands in his stead. Verse 16, there's no end of all the people, of what people? Even of all the people that have been before them. They also that shall come after shall not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So you got this second kid who comes on the throne, and all the people who live after that king, they don't remember him. Isn't that how Joseph's story continues? Started as a poor and wise child. He was thrown in prison. He became king. And then at the end of his life, it was given to somebody else. The people began to flourish. And how does the book of Exodus begin? There arose a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. What does that tell us about it? Why does he say all those things? Because none of those people got to decide that those things would happen. Joseph did what was right. Even though his brothers hated him, he was falsely accused, he had the opportunity to hurt people, all he did what was right. That's all that he did. He didn't decide to work for Potiphar. He didn't decide to put himself in a difficult situation with Potiphar's wife. He didn't decide to be living in the cell next to the butler and the baker. He didn't decide to be second in command. He just did in every situation what he knew was right. And that's all that he was supposed to do. And God put people in charge when he wanted them to be and removed them when he wanted them to be removed. And what is the point of him telling you all these things in Ecclesiastes? None of it is in your control. And we get very frustrated when we see it. When we're reading through the middle of Joseph's story, we feel like this isn't fair. No, it would be better if Joseph was served justice the whole time. That's what we think. But then God had a different plan than we did, besides the fact that we're not smart enough to see the work that God makes from the beginning to the end, chapter 3, but that God is in control and we're not, and so that's okay, chapter 1. And so the relationships that you are given, you take. And you accept them with an open hand, and what God gives to you, you obey with it. But you do not get to take them for yourselves. Whether or not there is justice everywhere around you, you don't always get to make that what you want it to be. You don't get to make the people in charge you want them to be. You don't get to decide what people are in your life and when they're not. But God gives you those things. And so take them when he gives them and do what is right. Because God will bring every work into judgment. At the end. So we'll continue with that. We'll continue to try to convince you that all is vanity in chapters 5 and 6 in the next couple weeks. And then we're going to get very quickly to the second half of the book, where we ask ourselves our question, well, then what am I supposed to do with that? What is it that God wants me to do then if all is vanity and he's in control and I'm not? If all is a vapor and I cannot grab it, what am I supposed to do? And we'll see that here very soon. So let's pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, thank you so much for your truths that you give us. We thank you that you admonish us and you show us the importance of obeying and living righteously and living wisely. But we also thank you that you are real with us and raw with us in your word. And you show us the truths that are around us in reality. So we recognize that our right decisions don't always make us get to dictate what the outcome of our life will be. So Lord, help us to trust you as we do what is right. And Lord, I pray that you would help each one of us to have a faith-filled life, recognizing that a whole life of the life of the Christian life is supposed to be one of trusting you and not ourselves. So help us to recognize that in the daily decisions that we make. I pray that you would be with the prayer requests we're about to hear in just a moment, that you would meet those according to your will. In your name, amen.